Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Word came out yesterday that the world's first recipient of a face transplant 11 years ago has died. In those years, transplants beyond the life-saving have become more common. Arms, hands, more faces, the transplanted uterus, the transplanted penis, parts of the body that make possible a normal life. Many scientists scoff, but doctors are now even talking about a transplanted head. This hour on Point, the frontier of human transplants. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Has your life been saved, made better by a transplant? How far does this go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will talk in a moment with Carmen Blandon-Tarleton, who received a face transplant in 2013. You may have seen the moment last month when 9-year-old Zion Harvey, who had a double hand transplant last summer, threw out the first pitch at a Baltimore Orioles game.
Doing the honors this evening is the first child in the world to undergo a bilateral hand transplant. He underwent the procedure last summer at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He has spent the last year working to regain hand function and the ability to throw a baseball through rigorous hand therapy sessions. Please join us in welcoming 9-year-old Zion Harvey. Okay, Zion, whenever you're ready, it's your pitch.
Sounds a little crazy there with the organ music in the background, but think of what that means for this boy. Joining me first today from New York is Alexandra Sifferlin, health writer for Time magazine. She's writing about transplants in this week's issue of Time. Alexandra, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's the trend?
Right. So as you mentioned, we're talking about transplants that don't save lives, like, say, a heart, but stand to dramatically improve them, whether that be a face, hands, a uterus. And in the last year, there have been several firsts in this area in the United States. There was the first child to receive a double hand transplant, as you mentioned, in July 2015. The next month, there was the most extensive face transplant ever performed at NYU. In February, Cleveland Clinic performed the first uterus transplant in the United States. And in May, Massachusetts General Hospital performed the first penis transplant. So not only is there a turning point in this field in terms of procedures performed, but what's also fascinating is that this new field has created a new risk-benefit ratio for doctors and for people receiving transplants to weigh. Anytime a person receives a transplant, whether it be a face or hands or a heart, they must start taking immunosuppressive drugs, basically drugs that suppress a person's immune system so that the immune system doesn't view the new part as something that's foreign that it needs to get rid of. These drugs are potent, however, and they are known to increase a person's risk for infections, heart disease, cancer, even shorten a lifespan. So what's fascinating about this field to me is how people reach the decision to undergo such a procedure and how surgeons decide this is experimental, this is risky, but I think it's worthwhile.
Alexander, how are medical professionals looking at this new trend? Are these firsts that you describe in the last year, and they're remarkable, each of them, to consider, are they seen as novelties? Are they seen as transplants that could become new norms for people in need?
Mm-hmm. So it depends a little bit on the procedure. Hands and limb transplants have had a longer history, both in the United States. The first hand transplant was performed in 1999. And many of these procedures have started in countries abroad. The uterus transplants were really done first in Sweden, and now different surgeons in the United States are taking on uterus transplant programs. So some of these people are beginning to say, you know, I think there's enough evidence that this works. I think this could become standard of care. But there are still some procedures like the uterus and the penis transplant that are still very new, and doctors are still in the early experimental stages, figuring out, will this work? Should this be something we offer regularly?
I want to talk about those, where those may go, the relative benefits and costs of transplants versus very advanced prosthetics, which we also hear about. Alexandra, stand by there in New York. Alexandra Sifferlin with Time Magazine is with us. Headline on her piece in this week's issue is The New Transplant Revolution. With us right now as well from Fairleigh, Vermont, is Carmen Blandon-Tarleton. In February 2013, she had a full face transplant done at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She had been burned over 80% of her body with industrial strength acid in an attack by her estranged husband. She's authored the book Overcome, tells that story. Carmen Blandon-Tarleton, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
How's it going? How's the transplant working out for you, Carmen?
You know, I actually am doing very well, considering I was just in a different position. Everybody who's had a face transplant or any kind of transplant has their own story. My story is I was so badly burned all over my body except for my hands and feet, and I had such severe scarring in my neck. I was on very large doses of narcotics for many years. And although I felt that a face transplant would not save my life in the way that a heart or a liver, those kind of internal organs do, it certainly prolonged my life. I felt strongly I was not going to survive and have any quality of life with the severe pain I had in my neck from the scarring and the amount of narcotics I was taking at the time.
Carmen, how is it now to live with the transplant? When you're out and about, do people see you as just another person on the street? Is it still clear that you've had some kind of significant procedure? They may not know what, but around your face? How do you feel about that?
Well, for me, I think, you know, I look pretty normal, except for one of my eyes is closed. I'm blind in one eye. I'm legally blind in the other eye.
Okay.
So, I only have one ear,
yep.
You know, so I still have a few things that you might look at and maybe, you know, look twice at me, but only if you're close enough to me in public.
Yep.
I don't get the stares I certainly got when I was a disfigured person.
You are a nurse, so you know something about procedures and recovery. I mean, how was this for you physically to go through?
Yeah, I was a nurse. I was in the nursing world for about 20 years before I was injured. And so I had the knowledge I needed to make that kind of decision. And I felt very comfortable making that decision to go forward with a face transplant. I never questioned it. I never went back and said, that never occurred for me. So, and that was, you know, that was one of the very many blessings.
I mean, it's not as if it was easy without the transplant. You'd had 58 surgeries before you got on the list for a face transplant, and then were fortunate to find someone who would make that available to you.
Right.
What about the psychological side of this? I mean, and I'm sure it's psychologically difficult before as well, but once you get a face transplant, you're taking someone else's physical features on your face. How's that been to work with?
Well, you know, it's been a really different experience. I've had three faces. I had the face I was born with the first 39 years, and then I had a severely disfigured face for almost six, and now for over three and a half, I've had my face transplant face. And it's but when I received the face transplant, you know, the aesthetics of what I looked like didn't really occur to me because I didn't really have a face transplant because of my disfigurement. It was more through my function and my pain.
Yes.
So after it has taken a while to get used to it on a psychological level, although it was never difficult for me. I never had anxiety or those kind of things. I could just observe when I looked in the mirror in the beginning, I didn't recognize myself. But I didn't recognize myself when I was disfigured either.
Yeah.
So it's certainly been a nicer feature by far to look in the mirror and not see that disfigured face.
Carmen, you're a very strong and cool-headed person about this, to hear you talk about it. Alexandra, when you listen to Carmen Blandon Tarleton, who's had a full the face transplant, and you think about others who have had significant transplants that you've spoken with, do they all have her kind of equanimity about it?
Yes, I think the people that I've spoken to who have undergone face transplants or are considering them have talked a lot about how it was very hard to live in society without the face transplant. Their quality of life was very much diminished, very difficult to walk in public without people staring. And for them, the risks associated with the surgery were well worth it for the chance to have, you know, a normal life again.
Carmen, you've never thought twice about it from what I can hear you saying today, or have you?
No, I really haven't. Because, I mean, and I think if, you know, if anybody had been in my shoes with the amount of narcotics I'd been taking for many years, and I was suffering on a daily level every day, and I knew I needed something significant to prolong my life. I knew I wasn't going to survive that long. So in that, when I was in that position, it was only a saving grace to have a face transplant. So even though there's a lot of risk to it and whatnot, it's been well worth it. It's been well worth it to me because it did not save my life immediately, but in a way, it has saved my life and prolonged my life.
And how do you think about the woman who gave you that face, Carmen?
You know, I think about her every day. I am very good friends and very close to her daughter, Narinda. And we, you know, we've gone and we've done speaking together on occasion. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful and appreciative that Cheryl, my donor, was a organ and tissue donor, and that Narinda, her daughter, allowed that decision to be made at that time.
Carmen Blandon Tarleton had a full face transplant in February of 2013. She's author of the book Overcome, about that story. Carmen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the expanding world of transplants. It's not just hearts and kidneys anymore. It's arms, hands, faces, the most intimate parts of our bodies. There are opportunities here and risks and issues. Alexandra Sifferlin is writing about all of it for Time magazine this week in her piece, The New Transplant Revolution. You can join us as well. Can you believe the range of transplants now going on? Is there anything we won't be able to use from someone else? Do you have any problem with transplants? Should we have any hesitation? Are you on a waiting list for something critical, life-saving? What do you think of people waiting for hands? Way back in 1967, Dr. Christian Barnard performed the world's first human heart transplant operation in South Africa. The patient was a 54-year-old grocer, suffered from diabetes and incurable heart disease, lived 18 days after that operation. Here, back in 67, Dr. Barnard gave his reaction to the operation at a press conference.
From here, we will build up, solve some of the problems and develop new means of treatment until such a stage that it will be a curative procedure.
Now we're well beyond hearts. We're talking about uterus, we're talking about penis, we're talking about faces. 9-year-old Zion Harvey, both hands, new transplants. He talked in August with NBC News a year after the surgery about how it had changed his life.
When I got my hands, it's like, here's the piece of my life that was missing. Now it's here. Now my life is complete.
We're going to talk in just a moment with the director of the hand transplantation program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, who led the team that performed the world's first bilateral hand transplant on Zion Harvey. Dr. Scott Levin will join us. It does not always work out to the recipient's satisfaction. 7 years after Jeff Kepner became the first person in the U.S. to have a double hand transplant. He said in a CBS interview in August that his hands still don't work as he wishes. He wished he'd like to not have them.
Has it gotten better or worse? Oh, worse. I was 75% mobile with my hooks. I could do a lot. Now I'm 0%.
So thinking back on his prosthetics, Alexander, what about satisfaction after these surgeries? They're complicated. They don't always work out. He wishes he had his prosthetics back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in many ways, I've also spoken to Jeff, and you know, he told me he's quite disappointed with what happened, and it's been a bit traumatic for him. As he mentioned, he was able to do a lot with his prosthetics before he got the transplant. He was able to hold a job. He could drive a car. He could get himself ready for work on his own. Today, he relies almost completely on his wife, Valerie, for almost everything. And he told me he spends a lot of time watching TV. On the other hand, he has also said that he doesn't blame the doctors who did the procedure in any way. He's told me, you know, this is the chance that I took, and this is what happened. And in some ways, it's the price of being first. And he's sort of been able to come to terms with that despite the results of his own transplant.
I mean, we all paid attention earlier this year when there was the word of a uterus transplant at Cleveland Clinic. This was a 26-year-old woman from Texas, Lindsay, mother of three adopted children. She wanted to be able to bear her own children and appeared at a news conference after that uterus transplant surgery, explained here why she wanted to go through the experimental operation.
I want to be open and honest and to share my story. And that began when I was 16 and was told I would never have children. And from that moment on, I have prayed that God would allow me the opportunity to experience pregnancy. And here we are today at the beginning of that journey.
Now, if you remember, the following day, doctors at Cleveland Clinic had to remove that uterus due to infection. I guess it was a yeast infection, Alexandra.
Mm-hmm.
What about that? Is there an ethical issue when, I mean, she could adopt children? You know, is there some, she wants the experience of being pregnant. There are many experiences people want. Are there medical ethicists who say, well, all right, but this is a lot of intervention for an experience?
Yes, there are definitely ethicists who've talked about whether some of these procedures are worth the risks that the people are taking. Are they worth taking the drugs every day for the rest of your life when you were an otherwise healthy person? In this case, you know, she has already adopted three children. She wanted to experience the phenomenon that is, you know, giving birth, something quite unique to the female body. And she had been talking to these researchers for 5 years leading up to the surgery, really weighing the options. But it is, it's complicated. And while I haven't spoken to any ethicists who say this should not happen, it really, many doctors are arguing it should very much be taken on a case-by-case basis and should, you know, largely be up to the individual whether they want to undergo the surgery and take on the responsibility of, you know, whatever happens afterwards.
There was a uterus transplant. What about the penis transplant you write about? What made that necessary and how's that working out?
Yes. So Thomas Manning, he's 64. He received the United States' first penis transplant, and it is the third to have ever been completed and the second to actually be successful so far. And he lost his penis to cancer. He's one of about 2,000 men who are diagnosed with penile cancer every year. And for him, he really felt incomplete. He told me for my story, you know, it was just a matter of they took my penis off and I wanted it back. And for him, it was something he asked for again and again and again. He just really felt like he could not move forward and feel whole without it. And so he underwent a 15-hour surgery and was given the penis from a deceased donor. And so far, it has been going well. He's able to go to the bathroom normally and so far hasn't had any issues of rejection.
So it's not been rejected. What about the full function? Will it even have sexual function? Is that anticipated or do they know?
That is the hope, and they say they're cautiously optimistic that he will regain sexual function, but it could take still a few months for that to happen.
Just amazing. Andrea Sefferlin, stand by with Time Magazine in New York. With us right now is Dr. L. Scott Levin. He's director of the Hand Transplantation Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. led the team that did the bilateral hand transplant. First, a world first on a child. That was a then 8-year-old Zion Harvey. Now 9, you heard him getting ready to throw the pitch out at the Baltimore Orioles game. He's professor of surgery at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, chairman of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Penn Medicine. Dr. Levin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you today.
What is your view now of what the future holds when it comes? Let's start with hands. We've heard for a long time about how great prosthetics were becoming. How do you decide whether you go for prosthetics or transplantation when it comes to hands, Dr. Levin?
Well, the natural evolution in transplant surgery, we follow in this new field called vascularized composite allotransplantation. We take our leads from the world of solid organ transplant. And we have now the ability to offer living organs in the forms of face or penis or abdominal wall, or you heard uterus, to patients as an alternative to other methods of function. In the case of upper extremity reconstruction, Tom, certainly we have a spectrum of care we offer the amputee. Some patients elect to never have a reconstruction, either with a prosthetic or techniques where we can move nerves around called targeted muscle reinnervation. That is a way to take residual nerves and innervate residual muscles and then have patients don a prosthetic that can be activated. But the field of VCA or vascularized composite allotransplantation started with the first hand transplant in 1998. And here we are 18 years later with very successful programs around the world, certainly several in the United States. And the point is, this is not forced on any patient. There's a very, very careful vetting, screening by the entire medical community to work these patients up. These are usually patients that receive hand transplants that have rejected or not been able to, for a variety of reasons, use their prosthetics. Actually, for your listeners, the criterion to actually be offered a prosthetic or try a prosthetic and then ultimately the patient rejects this for a variety of reasons is a step towards being considered for hand transplantation. So this is not something we go to immediately, but is done as part of a process for the amputee to regain function, sense of self, sense of body image, to integrate and touch another human being with a living hand that feels, to grasp a loved one's hand, embrace a child, eat, perform toileting. There's certain things that prosthetics, no matter how sophisticated, they cannot do. And again, a very, very careful process in terms of patient selection, in terms of patient preparedness and so forth, leads us to hand transplant.
We're learning a lot here, obviously. Where are the biggest challenges now? I mean, when you get into this vascularized composite transplantation, as you say, that's transplantation of multiple tissues, skin, blood vessels, muscles, nerves, bone, connective tissue.
Correct.
What's the most tricky? Where do the biggest challenges come in?
Well, like in any patient that undergoes an organ transplantation, the biggest challenges medically to overcome are the influences of the so-called drugs or the immunosuppressive therapy that patients that have a heart or a lung or a hand or a face have to take, as you said earlier, for the rest of their lives to prevent rejection. So this is the holy grail. There's lots of research being done in our basic science laboratories. More research certainly needs to be done to unlock the keys to the immune system that will allow us to modulate the system without drugs that in the long term have toxicity or adverse effects on patients, no matter how successful the organ transplant is. Parenthetically, the other challenges are social and economic in that solid organs such as lung and liver and other solid organs that are accepted today that are paid for by government payers and private insurance, these new VCA techniques are not covered yet by insurance, and we hope that they will follow the path of the solid organ transplants that have been done. The differential, of course, is that for the most part, the solid organs like heart and lung are life-saving, and similar in some ways to kidney, the VCAs, the face and the hands, are quality of life-saving. So nobody's going to die without a new face or new hands that are living hands that are taken from a donation, a donor. But the quality of life certainly has been enhanced in many of our VCA patients way beyond what conventional prosthetics can do, and has allowed patients to not only socially reintegrate with the world around them, but go out into public and hold jobs and reintegrate into society. And I think that's the most important factor.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Levin,
talk to us about the nervous system when there's a transplantation, let's say of hands, or anything that where we would normally expect to have feeling. Do you presume that after the transplant, the recipient will have full feeling through these transplanted, in your case, let's say, hands here? Or is it an open question? Do the nerves of the transplanted hand just hook up with the nerves of the recipient's body and just start reporting into the brain? How does that work?
Well, it's an excellent question. And, of course, the result in terms of function, in terms of being able to feel, the so-called term we use is sensibility, to be able to touch and feel things, and the ability of these nerves to reinnervate or reactivate muscles from the donor, those factors are varied by the level at which the transplant is performed and the quality of the nerve repair. The age of the patient has an influence. Actually, some of the drugs that we use called calcineurin inhibitors actually, we believe, enhance the nerve generation. But the ability to flex and extend the fingers in a hand transplant, the ability to feel, is dependent on the nerve coaptation or hookup, as you suggest. And the nerves regenerate, but they regenerate in a normal condition where a nerve, let's say, is cut in an injury and repaired under the microscope. The reinnervation, as we call it, is variable. And there are factors that can influence this, as I said, such as age, the timing of the repair. That's not pertinent in terms of hand transplant. But for example, in our pediatric patient Zion Harvey, the center of his brain that controlled feeling and muscle movement was asleep for 6 years. And fortunately for him, he's a child. That brain center, we're studying him. It's waking up, and he can flex and extend his fingers. He has feeling. There are other patients, as was alluded to earlier, where perhaps the reinnervation process of making the muscles work, meaning the fingers flex and extend, the fingers move, perhaps that innervation process is not as effective for a variety of reasons, and therefore the function is less and may lead to some degree of patient dissatisfaction. But in our particular program at the University of Pennsylvania, we've had excellent success with the reinnervation at a proximal level amputee that we've done, and Zion's doing well. But again, as you point out, there are several factors, and the variable factors will lead to variable function. We certainly never tell patients they're going to be normal, but hopefully a semblance of function that is better than an amputated limb, functioning better, obviously, because of sensory feedback with a vascularized transplant compared to a prosthesis. I hope this answers your question.
Yeah. Alexander Siflin, you're listening there in New York with Time Magazine. What are you hearing as you did your reporting? Are people looking at this kind of transplant as, you know, sort of Star Trek stuff that we have achieved but will always be rare? Or is it possible that it might become routine for people facing these challenges?
I think the entire solid organ transplant community, Tom, and our VCA community, that is an international body of surgeons, ethicists, scientists, immunologists, psychiatrists, we hope this will become a mainstream transplant. We believe it is, and it's following the pathway, as I said earlier, of what's occurred in the solid organ world. When Dr. Starzl did his first liver transplants, patients had some complications. Now it's mainstream. Joe Murray, the late Joe Murray, the Nobel Prize winner in 1954, transplanting the Couric twins at the Brigham Hospital in Boston. This was groundbreaking work. Now kidney transplant is routine. And we hope that faces and hands and other body parts, as we evolve and we follow the history and the legacy of solid organ, will evolve in VCA world as well.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the expanding world of transplants. It's not just hearts and kidneys anymore. It's arms, hands, faces, the most intimate parts of our bodies. There are opportunities here and risks, and as we are hearing, issues as well. You can join us. Dr. Scott Levin is with us. He's director of the Hand Transplantation Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Zion Harvey, who you heard the tape at the top of the show of when he was throwing out the pitch at the Baltimore Orioles game, well, that young man, that boy, came through the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia program. Both hands, transplants. Alexandra Sifferlin is with us as well from New York, health writer for Time Magazine. The New Transplant Revolution is her piece this week. You can join us. Is there anything we shouldn't transplant? Why not? Alexandra, there was a report just in the last couple of days of the woman who had the world's first partial face transplant, a French woman, Isabella Dunois, dying 11 years after that surgery. The hospital hasn't said there, I guess, whether it was related to the transplant, but it's a reminder that this is certainly not without risk, Alexandra.
Right. It is a reminder. And as you said, it hasn't been confirmed that the face transplant had a role in her death. But there have been around 38 face transplant procedures performed worldwide, and 65% of face transplant recipients have experienced some signs of rejection within the first year of that transplant. So it does underline the fact that there are risks involved.
You've got the doctor in France who's done 7 of the 10 face transplants there now arguing for suspending that procedure so the medical community can take stock. The Washington Post is reporting here whether the long-term benefits are worth the physical and psychological toll they take on patients. I mean, as you say, these require maintenance and the psychological factor. Dr. Levin talked about the sense of self. What have you learned about how that comes into play, Alexandra?
Absolutely. It's unique when it comes to face transplants, especially for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. I think the program at NYU approaches this in a unique way. They performed in August, August 2015, the most extensive face transplant ever performed on a former volunteer firefighter named Patrick Hardison, who lives in Mississippi. And they basically developed a team where they have an ethicist, a psychologist, a surgeon. And they visited Patrick at his home in Mississippi several different times to kind of ensure that he and his family fully understood what he might look like, what the aftermath could be, to ensure that he had the social support in his family as well as in his community to help him through this, through the healing, through the rehab. And the lead surgeon on that team, Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez, said that he is concerned about identity. It's one of his greatest concerns that people who will undergo face transplants will assume that they'll look like the way they used to before their injury, and when in fact, that cannot be promised. But they do hope for some resemblance. And for his team, they spent almost a year trying to find the ideal donor, someone who matched Patrick's features, at least closely in terms of skin tone and hair, mm-hmm. to hopefully help that process.
We're going to talk in just a moment with medical ethicist Dr. Lainey Friedman Ross in Chicago. But here's the voice of the Mississippi firefighter, Patrick Hardison. Received the most complex face transplant in history last summer and talked recently with Time magazine about how the transplant has changed his life.
Give me a new life, and it's given me hope that I could walk down the street and I'd be stared at. Like, well, damn, go swimming now. That I hadn't done in 15 years because I had a trach and all that stuff. And it's just everything totally different. I can see the drive now. I mean, things I couldn't do. It's changed my life dramatically.
Dr. Scott Levin of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is with us as well. Dr. Levin, you mentioned sense of self. You work with hands. Is there a psychological question around sense of self, even with extremities, not necessarily the face?
Well, absolutely, Tom. I mean, one of the interesting things about face transplant for patients that are able to see and aren't blind, only if you look in a mirror would you see either your new transplant, which is a blend of the facial skeletal features of yourself and then the transplant from somebody else, to give you a new identity. But we look at our hands all the time. The handshake, how we gesticulate, how we reach and embrace people, how we socially greet people. And without that, people become socially isolated. Can you do it with a prosthetic? To a degree, you can. But in a recent case that we transplanted, the woman remarked what a wonderful sense it was to be able to scratch her nose or touch her own skin with her fingertips that were her own living parts of her hand. You can't do that with a prosthetic. So there are human issues, there are ethical issues, but I would not underestimate for hand or any other body part, face, hand, penis, abdominal wall, the need to be whole again, to be complete, not only anatomically, but perhaps a sense of self, as I've described, that is an emotional human condition component. Yeah. I will underscore that all of the patients that are considered for transplant undergo a very, very thorough vetting process, as you've described with Dr. Rodriguez, who's a dear colleague and a friend. You mentioned the French program. There's a very compelling video that Professor Laurent Lantieri has of one of his first face transplants, where in a Christmas market in Paris, he has a video of little children staring at his first patient that had a condition called neurofibromatosis, which is a distortion of the face. Dr. Lantieri is a world expert in this. And then a year later shows him in the same Christmas market, enjoying the displays in the shops. No one's staring at him. He's walking around with his family and feels part of society again. I mean, your listeners and you yourselves, and even on an ethical basis, that's compelling. I don't care who you are, what the pros and cons are, their exit strategies. Yes, there are complications. Yes, we're evolving. But you look at that patient in the Christmas market with being ridiculed and stared at by children in public, and then a year later looking normal as he can be. And again, the person who goes out with bilateral prosthetics, I want to emphasize to your listeners that those that have prosthetics are very, very functional. Our military has done a wonderful job with the evolution of the creation of newer and newer prosthetics to give our wounded warriors hope. But transplant is just one option for reconstruction, but the ability to touch a loved one with his or her own hand, to touch your face, to feel your own skin on skin. These are things that a prosthetic, at least in today, in 2016, cannot do.
Dr. Scott Levin, stand by. Joining us today from Sicily in Italy and Alexandra Seferlin in New York, Dr. Lainey Friedman Ross joins us right now, professor of clinical medical ethics at the University of Chicago, co-author of Transplantation Ethics. Dr. Lainey Friedman Ross, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So, when you look at this new frontier of transplantation, what ethical issues should we be attuned to?
Well, I think many of them have already been mentioned. The real issue is about getting an appropriate informed consent that the potential recipients understand truly the risks and the benefits. The benefits we've been hearing a lot about, being able to go in public and not being stared at, being able to touch one's face, and all of these things are great. The risks have to be also really emphasized. There are the risks from the immunosuppression, especially with cancer and infection, diabetes, kidney disease, such that somebody getting a face transplant may end up then needing a kidney transplant because of the kidney disease that follows.
Because of the long-term need for these immunosuppressant drugs.
Correct. So, you know, when we talk about whether this will become mainstream, the real answer for that is if we can develop some way of developing tolerance to these foreign bodies that, in a sense, become part of us, that will be the real answer to be making vascular composite allografts mainstream.
What about cost issues here to families, individuals, or to society? Is there an ethical issue there? These are quite expensive procedures.
Well, they are really expensive, and one of the biggest expenses is the psychological component is so expensive because so many potential candidates really aren't appropriate candidates after a very high screening. So when you look at some of the studies, what you find out is the hundreds of people who are screened before one or two or three individuals are deemed appropriate candidates. So we have to start with that cost. Then we could get to the cost of, you know, dozens and dozens of doctors and nurses in the operating room. But then there's the months to years of rehabilitation. So the costs are great. But what you hear from recipients, particularly for recipients when there's a good outcome, is that they really do feel like they have a life that's come back to them. I mean, one of the things we often talk about this is not life-saving, like a kidney or a liver, and yet when you hear some of the recipients, what you hear is it really is life-saving. It made it from somebody who couldn't leave their house to somebody who can now go swimming again and be in a Christmas market and things of that sort.
Dr. Ross, we talk about organ donors. We all know what that is, what that means. But these are not organs. When we talk about extremities, we talk about a face or hands or penis. Where do these come from? Who's signing up to volunteer these? How does it work?
That's really important. So right now, for those of us who have signed our organ donor cards or have gone online for first-person consent, most of us expect that when they come to take our organs, they're taking our internal organs, like you just said, a heart, yeah, liver, kidneys, if we're healthy enough and all of that sort. And I think that all the organ procurement organizations here in the United States would never take any of these other organs without explicitly discussing it with the family extensively. I mean, it is an incredible gift that these families are, in a sense, consenting to for their families. I would hope as an ethicist that would become part of also our first-person consent organ registries, that we're able to say that you can take not just my life-saving organs, but that you can take physical organs that could be visible, right, with an open casket type of thing. There's a lot of work being done even for open casket funerals, such that prostheses are being made, in a sense, for the decedent in order that they can have an open casket and be able to have those type of death rituals that some families find very important.
Right.
So I think we're doing it on both sides, and I think that's very important. So I do think that the consent of the family is critical. What we've also heard today is that many times the recipients are actually meeting members of the family, and that's something I think that also needs to be followed and studied, how that's both the benefits and risks for the families that have been so generous in their donation, as well as for these recipients, about what type of gratitude they feel they owe and things of that sort, because that can get messy.
We've had callers waiting so long. Let me go to them. Richard in Austin, Texas. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is that I, 35 years, 40 years ago, signed papers as an organ donor. And I still continue that on here in Texas. It's on your driver's license. Mm-hmm. And I've made sure that my family understands that when I pass away, that this body is just a physical thing. It is not me. And don't try to make it into me. And that they should give any and all parts necessary to help some other person, that they can take anything. And they were talking about just the organs or physical things. My family knows that everything is to be given.
So if it was your hands or your face that got a new life, Richard, you would be comfortable with that?
Oh, sure. If somebody wants this ugly puss of mine, they can have it.
You're a generous man, Richard. You're a generous man, and I appreciate your call from Austin, Buffalo, New York. Susan's calling. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is, I donated a kidney to my husband 16 years ago, and it truly gave him and our family our life back.
Mm.
The difference in quality of life from being on dialysis, for example, we just got back from 2 weeks in Alaska. You could never do a trip like on dialysis. And although the medications, obviously he's been on immunosuppressants for 16 years, he has had some issues with prostate cancer and skin cancer, but he was able to work full-time until he retired. He was a critical care nurse, and he's enjoying our grandchildren. And
what a great gift from you, Susan. What about when you hear about hands or faces or other kinds of, not internal, like the kidney you gave your husband, but external or extremities? How do you think about it?
I I am all for it. I think that the medical technology and science is moving along rapidly, and I think anything that can increase the quality of somebody's life, even if it's for a day, is well worth it. And as we go along, as people have procedures, we learn more, and all of that knowledge will be shared across the world to where kidney transplant is routine now.
Yeah. Susan, you're a good and generous person, and certainly wife. I hear everything you gave your husband with that donation of a kidney to him all those years ago. Dr. Ross, listening in Chicago, where do you expect this will go? That transplantation along this wide horizon may become common, or that prosthetics will take the lead over time and maybe be less expensive and fewer difficulties with rejection?
Right. So my predictions, what a dangerous thing to do.
Yes.
But my prediction would be if we could figure out a way of tolerance, that transplant would be the way to go. I think in the meantime, our prostheses really are becoming much, much, much better. And in fact, some prostheses are even developing some ability to sensate, to have feeling, and that will be critical to make it as a real viable alternative to transplant. So I really do think, particularly for many organs, this issue of needing the immunosuppression is what's pushing us. I would just like to comment on one of the things Richard said, which is really important for those of us who are potential donors, those of us who have signed our organ donor cards. The most important thing is for us to explain that decision to our family so that our families have it much easier at the time of our death to know that what they're doing is exactly what we would have wanted if we could speak for ourselves at that moment, and that they're doing something that's really respectful of the wishes of their loved one.
If you're prepared to share and share all that, let them know, because that's what it comes to on the other side of death, if there's a need. What an interesting hour on a frontier I did not know so very well. Dr. Lainey Friedman Ross at the University of Chicago, professor of clinical medical ethics there. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ross.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott Levin, director of the Hand Transplantation Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, joining us today from Sicily, no less. Enjoy Sicily, Dr. Levin, and thank you for being with us.
Tom, on behalf of Penn Medicine, thank you for your time and the ability to speak to your listeners.
It's been great. And Alexandra Sifferlin at Time Magazine, thanks so much, Alexandra.
It's good to be here.
Headline, The New Transplant Revolution. This is On Point.